welcome to Your Health, a weekly podcast from the Science Desk at NPR. I'm Patty Namond. This week, we've got information for parents. Have you ever wondered why whooping cough is so dangerous for young children? Or why kids start acting out once they hit the teen years? We'll have those answers for you. But first up, a story on drug pamphlets. We're talking about the attachment that comes with the medicine you get from the pharmacy. Some patients may say the instructions are too long and too difficult to read. Many people wind up chucking it. NPR's April Fulton reports on what the Food and Drug Administration is doing to change that.
Joe Graydon is a pharmacologist who runs a website called The People's Pharmacy. He helps people get information about drugs. He doesn't put much stock in the current leaflets.
They may not have adequate information. They may have conflicting information. They may have confusing information. A lot of times there's too much information. Sometimes there's not enough. It's just a big mess.
Graydon says there's only a few key things patients need to know.
What are the most common side effects? What are the symptoms to be looking for? And then, what should you do if they happen?
Graydon says the leaflets are so variable that even when they're supposed to be about the same drugs, they offer conflicting information.
When we began to hear that certain medications, for example, some statin-type drugs like maybe Lipitor or Zocor, could interact with grapefruit juice, there was a tremendous amount of confusion.
At the time, some of these leaflets did tell consumers taking these drugs to avoid grapefruit juice. But some told people to wait 24 hours, he says. Some didn't say anything at all. It's not just contradictory information, though. Another more basic problem with the leaflets is length. Carol Kimberlin is a professor at the University of Florida. She and her colleagues sampled leaflets from some 400 pharmacies across the country recently at the request of the FDA.
Some of them were as little as 30 words, while others were over 2,500 words.
Even when the leaflets contain the right information, patients often have to search with a magnifying glass to find the important stuff, she says. And it's really important for people to get this information, says the FDA's Rachel Behrman.
A critical element of drug safety is safe use, of using it properly and without appropriate information. A patient may not be able to do that.
In fact, the new study showed at least a quarter of patients are not getting useful information with their prescriptions. But these problems have existed for decades. The FDA has been working with pharmacies and data providers using voluntary standards. When the agency tried to get the authority to dictate how the pamphlets should be written, it never succeeded. Behrman is confident, though, that their bid to simplify and shorten the drug handouts will succeed this time.
Our position has not changed. I believe the political climate has changed, and interest in having this kind of information available has changed.
She also thinks the FDA can justify shorter documents now because of the internet. If people need more information, they can go online. At least one of the stakeholders in this process says an FDA rule isn't the solution. Gerald McAvoy works for an association of hospital pharmacists. His group provides information about drugs to pharmacies so they can create their own leaflets. He thinks that even with new authority for the FDA, the drug industry will debate or challenge almost every word in the leaflets, and nothing will change. To him, this stuff should stay voluntary. What happens on this issue is important. Medication errors injure about 1.5 million people a year in the U.S. April Fulton, NPR News.
In California, the state's health department is confronting the worst outbreak of pertussis in 50 years. We know the condition is whooping cough. 2,700 cases have been reported already this year, and 7 babies have died. A vaccine can eliminate the problem, but many children aren't getting it. NPR's Guy Raz talked with Dr. Harvey Karp. Karp is a world-renowned pediatrician and author of The Happiest Baby on the Block. He tells us why it's important to protect kids from the whooping cough disease.
It's dangerous for little kids. It's not so dangerous for big kids. Matter of fact, for a lot of adults, you might just have a bad cold and a cough that lingers, and that's the only sign of whooping cough you have. But the younger you are, the smaller your windpipe is, With whooping cough, you get a very thick, tenacious type of mucus. When that develops in children, they can close off their breathing tube, and they cough so hard, literally, they can't keep anything in their stomachs. They have to be on IVs because they're coughing so hard, and they can even cough so hard that they get brain hemorrhage and die. And that's the number one way that these kids die, either from brain hemorrhage or they develop a severe pneumonia.
Why is this the worst outbreak in California in 50 years? Why is it happening now?
Well, I think it is in part because of parents not having their kids immunized, and it's in part because the immunity of people who were immunized earlier has waned. That's the other big issue that's going on now, which is that by the time those kids grow up, 10, 11, 12 years of age, they, even though they got their shots as babies, they may have no immunity left. They're spreading it around. Then the parent brings it home to their young child. So back in 2005, we started an initiative to have all older children and adults vaccinated as well, so we could develop this thing called herd immunity, get enough people immunized in the community so that the chance of bringing it home to your child is going to be greatly reduced.
Hmm. I had not known, for example, about the booster shot. Why isn't that information out there? I mean, I would assume that many adults in this country don't know that they should get a vaccination for this.
Well, I think that that's the physician's responsibility, that doctors, especially pediatricians, aren't doing a good enough job. Because you go into the doctor's office for your child's care, and your pediatrician should be telling you, hey, Guy, you and your wife should be getting immunized as well. So that, I think, is the responsibility and the burden of the public health department to do a better job communicating that.
Why do you think the public relations battle when it comes to vaccinations seems to be on the losing side right now?
Well, I think that, number one, parents are very busy. They're overburdened. They're working hard, working double jobs. I mean, it's really a burden to have to be a parent and then also have to be a biochemist and have to decide, read the literature, you know, what vaccines are good, what vaccines aren't good. In the background, we have this increasing incidence of autism, which is incredibly frightening. Then you have talking heads on the media saying it may be related to vaccines. So all of that have stopped parents in their tracks from wanting to take any chance that they were going to expose their child to something that might be dangerous. I totally understand that and sympathize with that. The good news is we have a large body of information now to show zero association between vaccines and autism. But we do need to try to help parents figure all of this information out so they can make sense and make the best decisions for their kids.
That's pediatrician and child development specialist Dr. Harvey Karp. He's a fellow at the American Academy of Pediatrics and the author of The Happiest Baby on the Block. He joined us from KCRW in Santa Monica. Dr. Karp, thank you so much.
Hey, Guy. Thank you very much.
If you've ever bickered with a kid, you'll appreciate this next story. Scientists can now explain what's going on biologically when kids misbehave. And they got some tips that might work for parents, including mothers like Taryn Cregan. Taryn Cregan is a single parent who lives in Mays Landing, New Jersey, with her 13-year-old daughter, Zoe.
I still have, on some days, a wonderful relationship with my daughter. But it goes from this really back-and-forth loving relationship to almost seeming like that person looks at you like you're enemy number one all the time. You know, it's really tough.
Especially since Taryn and Zoe used to be so close. They had lots of fun, says Taryn. Camping, going to the theater, to museums.
She's really a beautiful person. I see her with small children at camp and her little cousins and stuff, and she's fabulous. And she's really sweet with her aunts, her uncle, my mom. It's just me.
And now, pretty much every single morning, Taryn says, there's an argument about something. Take one morning not long ago.
I was getting ready for work. She's getting ready for camp. And I can hear her in the living room, and I can hear, like, hairspray. And I was like, Zoe, are you spraying hairspray while you're sitting on the couch? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, why are you doing that? You're going to get hairspray on the couch. And then it just, you know, she's like, well, you were in the bathroom, and I didn't want to be in your way. And then I say, well, Zoe, that's why I told you that you need to get ready up in your room. Well, I didn't feel like walking up the stairs again. And by this time, like, you know, I'm really frustrated because I'm, you know, why am I going back and forth with this person? So I don't think I'm being unreasonable, but she's coming back at me like I am being unreasonable.
A pretty typical dilemma, says psychologist Laura Kastner, who for more than 30 years has been helping parents work toward more calm in the home. Kastner is a clinical psychologist in Seattle, and she teaches at the University of Washington. In this situation, she says, both mother and daughter have gotten tangled up in what Kastner describes as emotional flooding.
And when we flood, we are having neurons fire in this emotional part of the brain. And so our heart rate goes up. We have distorted cognitions. You know, we think in terms of black-white terms. So it's, I'm good, you're bad. And they're both doing that at the same time, right? It's the worst time in any intimate relationship. You know, the daughter feels attacked. She's just innocently sitting there, you know, trying to get her hair done. And the mother sees her new sofa about to be ruined.
Over the past decade, researchers have provided Kastner and other psychologists with biological evidence that explains why teenagers see things and react to things so differently than adults. Take, for example, facial expressions.
They're more likely to see, for instance, a classic face that depicts surprise as anger and hostility.
Pediatrician James Chhatra is in private practice in Redmond, Washington. He describes how at about age 12, the teenage brain begins a massive shift in the prefrontal cortex, or the thinking part of the brain.
Sometimes that prefrontal cortex that allows us to take a break, stop, and think, it's not working as well. It's going through this amazing pruning and rewiring shift. So it becomes this compelling picture of, if you know that these neurons are getting wiped out in large amounts, what do you do as a parent?
Chhatra and Kastner agree. For starters, parents have to understand the neurological changes occurring in their teenager, changes that cause teens to take big risks and sometimes even do dangerous things. Like this scenario, says Kastner, say your child goes to a sleepover, the kids sneak out, go to someone's house, and spray shaving cream all over the house and cars. The police come and give them a tongue lashing and send them back to the host family, who promptly delivers them home to you in the middle of the night. The natural reaction for many parents, says Kastner, is to say, what were you thinking? But the joke's on us, she says. They weren't thinking.
They were running like wildebeest in the canyon, just go, 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 go. You know, they were flooded and excited and not really thinking through the consequences of their action.
Even in this situation, Kastner says to parents, the first line of defense, stay calm. Tell the teen to just go to bed and that you'll deal with consequences tomorrow. Then, the next day, the parent takes charge. Here's Kastner's recommendation. Sit the teenager down and say something like this.
What I want you to do is I want you to write a note about self-reflection and self-critique about how you got into this incident. And I want you to write about what you would do differently if you had another chance at it, what your regrets are, where you went off track, what skills you might need to do this differently the next time, your ideas about reparation to the family, the host family, the family that got shaving creamed all over their house, maybe even to the police officer that wasted his time on you. So write this down. And based on the quality of this self-critique, I will decide some discipline, but it will be small, medium, or large, based on the quality in which I think you've learned from your mistake here.
And there's another benefit to the writing and self-critique. It stimulates the thinking part of the teen brain and gets them away from the emotional frenzy. Steering clear of emotions is difficult for adults, too. But it's something parents just have to learn how to do, says Kastner. Pediatrician James Chhatra says there's a lot of evidence behind her advice.
She incorporates this mountain of good research and says, practically, this is how you can apply this. This is how it translates when you're trying to think about your conversations with your kids. So the key thing with her, she brings good science, good research to the old art of parenting.
Kastner offers strategies to help parents stop arguments with teens in their tracks. Here's Taryn Cregan's description of something practically every parent lives through.
I recently started in the past couple months trying to tell her just to say, okay, mom, when I ask her to do something, just say, okay, mom, and that's it, and that's all you have to say, and things will be so much better. But she can't string those two words together, ever. Like, she just can't. She has to say the last thing.
Let them have the last word.
Laura Kastner.
A lot of parents say, I'm not going to let them get away with that. I said, you might be right, but are you effective? So parents are often taking the bait of teenagers just throwing all that stuff. I want to live elsewhere. You're meanest mom. You don't make my brother do anything. And they're just all these wild sort of attacking statements to make us co-miserable because we're the boss of the home and whatever. But we need to let that riffraff go and just cease and desist because it's going nowhere. And a lot of extended arguments that happen with children are happening because we take the bait.
So in the case of Taryn, Zoe, the couch, and the hairspray, Kastner suggests that Taryn simply say, stop the hairspray, and forget the back and forth arguing. Laura Kastner.
You know, when we're in an emergency situation, it's really helpful to look at ourselves as being like policemen or firemen or a pilot that needs a protocol, an emergency room physician, you know, a protocol. Don't think, just do the protocol. The protocol is first and foremost, cool down. Because we don't want to drive under the influence of alcohol, and we don't want to talk to our loved ones under the influence of extreme emotion.
Take a breath, says Kastner. Go outside for a minute. The important thing, she says, get calm. Patty Namond, NPR News. Finally, down in the Gulf, residents are struggling with health problems caused by the oil spill. NPR's Leanne Hansen talked to Dr. Erwin Redliner from the National Center for Disease Preparedness at Columbia University. Redliner directed a telephone survey of more than 1,000 residents on coastal Louisiana and Mississippi. Leanne asked him what kind of psychological long-term effects we're starting to see.
Really, one of the survey's most startling results is that 30% of children living within 10 miles of the water have, according to their parents, experienced either a medical or mental illness since the spill. What kinds of illnesses are we talking about?
The medical side included very severe rashes or coughing or wheezing that was otherwise unexplained, and then a host of psychological consequences, which included depression, difficulty sleeping, and a variety of other problems that these children were expressing. Even 9-year-old children were talking about their way of life being over. That was a pretty hair-raising experience to hear so many young people talk about the end of a way of life.
And what about the adults?
Well, the adults also have just an unrelenting amount of anxiety about the consequences of this massive oil catastrophe down there. Tremendous instability in families around livelihood, around the possibility of having maybe to move away from the region, by the way, which about 1 out of 4 families already have been talking about. And the families themselves are having lots of discord. Very stable families under these kinds of pressures are feeling lots of stress. There's been an increase in domestic violence and even reports of suicide in some of these coastal communities.
Is it possible to say with certainty which illnesses, either psychological or physical, are directly tied to the spill?
Well, that's a very good question, and the answer to that right now is no. What we set out to establish was that there was the appearance of new symptoms, and then the question of, well, are they actually related? Can we prove they're related to the oil disaster? No, but anecdotally, the sense of physicians and clinicians who have been down there is that there is some tie. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to explain what would have caused a sudden, very dramatic increase in a lot of these symptoms that, as I say, did not exist before the oil spill.
In terms of symptoms, did you see more in lower-income households?
Yes, we saw significantly more in lower-income households, and this really reinforces a well-known notion that people who are vulnerable for whatever reason before a disaster, because of income, other disparities, racial disparities, those kind of individuals and populations are much more vulnerable.
Is it because perhaps lower income households, it's more difficult for them to get either medical or psychological care? They're underserved, in other words?
That is true. And the families that are most vulnerable, and this was true with Katrina, those that have the least are affected the most.
You mentioned Hurricane Katrina, and I understand your center studied Gulf residents back then, 5 years ago as well. Does Katrina's legacy compound the difficulties that these coastal residents face now?
These are multiple traumatized populations and communities. And then there's what we were referring to as, in essence, a failed recovery for many, many families, post, even 5 years post Katrina debacle. And on top of that comes the oil spill. So we're in really uncharted territory as far as understanding the impact of these multiple psychological traumas.
Dr. Erwin Redliner of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness. He's also author of the book, Americans at Risk. He joined us from our New York bureau. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's all for Your Health this week. If you want to hear more, check us out at npr.org/health. I'm Patty Niemand, and thanks for listening.